The ways in which social media and other tech companies design their services is being seen as one of the reasons many adolescents are becoming addicted to the services and their phones. On this episode of Today in Tech, we'll continue our exploration into the issues around social media addiction. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Today in Tech. I'm Keith Shaw. Joining me on the show today is Dr. Lisa Stroman. She is founder and CEO of the Digital Citizen Academy, as well as a licensed psychologist, author, speaker, and attorney. Welcome to the show, Dr. Stroman.
Thank you for having me.
Wow, you're busy.
I am busy. Yes.
again, I appreciate you being on the show here. We've talked our previous episode. We talked with an attorney who's involved in the multi-district lawsuit. So we're not going to get into a lot of the lawsuit aspects of it. But I do wanted to ask, because you are a licensed psychologist, about some of the things that are potentially causing kids to be addicted to social media. So just off the front, I think the first big question that I have is, how much research has there been in this space? As I was doing research for the episode, you know, initially it was only done by the companies themselves, but now we're starting to see more and more third party kind of evidence that is showing a link in the brain science, correct?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, if you go back, I've been in this field and working in this space for over two decades. So when I look back, particularly at the research and how it's come along, you can go all the way back to the original. So you have to think in 97 was kind of the first 6 degrees at AOL came out. Friendster was 2002. Like, so we go way, way back in terms of like when we started with this. But 2015, for context for the listeners, is that there was like 1,500 plus PubMed scientific research articles published about internet addiction. The problem is the vernacular has never been the same, but it isn't the same. So the American Psychological Association, the DSM, Diagnostic Statistical Manual, that's kind of our Bible in psychology and psychiatry. And so they put it in under behavioral addictions way back in 2013 is when they first started looking at it. But the research itself has really struggled with, is this a gaming disorder? Is this internet? Is it problematic use? Is it, so there's all these definitions, but they really truly are looking all at the same symptomology. And there is just thousands and thousands of articles out there that talk about how addictive it is.
Okay. And so again, because it was general internet addiction or another aspect of it, there haven't been as many around just the issue of social media per se, right?
As of late in the last 10 years, there has been. So if you look at when social media took off, and again, like you have to, like when it was released and when it happened, it probably took about 2 to 3 years for it to happen. The pandemic, like it was like wildfire. So, you know, during 2020, 2022, that's really where now you've got a lot of research going on and looking at kind of structural impacts. They're looking at neurochemical impacts. And we can do that through actual science of like looking at brain scans, SPECT scans, fMRIs, things like that. So that's all happening.
Okay. And in the most possible layman terms that you can provide without getting way too technical on the psychological aspects of it or the science part of it, what did the research show, that there was a link between either just, was it brain chemistry? Was it just your brain changed? What were the links that they found?
So a couple of different threads. Yeah. So one of them was the neurochemical, like where the dopamine, so we have neurochemicals in our brain, and basically that like feeds us kind of emotion. And so we have a regulatory system that does that. And dopamine is really truly that kind of the main neurochemical in our brain. And so what social media has tapped into is the ability to heighten and to train an anticipatory response. So the notifications that we get, the buzzes that we get, all of the things and the tricks and tools that they're using is really actually facilitating and adding fire to that system for us.
Yeah.
And so once you feel it, it's kind of like, you know, if you've never had a Snickers bar, you're never going to crave a Snickers bar. But once you feel it one time, now your brain's like, ooh, that felt really good. I want that again. And so that's the neurochemical thread that has changed structurally in the brain and has impacted kids. The other part is the actual structural component. So if you took a brain and you set it on the table, it would look all, you know, kind of gooey. The outside of it is our I'm trying to talk layman's, but that part that has all the crevices is the gray matter, and that's where we get creative thinking and thoughts. And then the internal part of a brain that holds everything together is the white matter. So there's gray matter and white matter, they work together in order to get things done. What we see in the research when we're doing these fMRIs and these SPECT scans is that there are actually deteriorations where it's atrophying and dying off. And so you see holes in the brain for overuse. And so that is where we are now. We understand that there is a structural damage that's occurring.
Wow.
Problematic use.
Yeah. Okay. And so social media has been around for about 20 years, at least Facebook has, and you've got some more mobile versions like Instagram, TikTok, and Snapchat. They've been around 8 to 15 years. Why are we now looking at this as an issue, whether it's us in the media, whether it's governments? I mean, again, just a few weeks ago, we were talking about, you know, they've got TikTok bans going all over the place. Like, why are we noticing this now? Is it because more of that third party research is coming out? Is it just a big wave that's happening? What are you seeing?
Well, I think that there's like some probably social reasons, and I think that there's definitely some political reasons that are happening. I'll start with the social. Socially, I think that we see the deterioration and the mental health crisis that is impacting our children.
Right.
Our suicide rates have never been this high. Self-harm rates have never been that high. If you look at the CDC data, there's a 20-year study. You can see precisely when Instagram and Snapchat were released, and then again when TikTok was released, that self-harm and suicidality went up in each of those years and continues to spike based on the content. So socially, I think that we've got enough people that are recognizing that our society isn't okay. And that is why I think that there's more attention towards it. If I move over to kind of the political area of it, I think that we've got a lot of finance. This is a $1 billion industry. And I think when you look at the power that the industry has wielded and the ability to control it through those financial means, we haven't had any success in addressing it from a legislative perspective.
Yeah.
Because we have too much money in the table, you know? And so it's really, really hard to advocate change when you're paying off the people that are, you know, supposed to be making the changes in the laws. So
right, right.
It gets complicated very quickly.
You know, within your own practice in your own life, have you seen, you know, kind of these warning signs, these symptoms of social media addiction as being a problem for younger, you know, adolescents or younger children or even teenagers or is there something else?
No, absolutely. You know, I'm a clinical psychologist, private practice. I see probably about 60 to 70% teenagers or young adults. I had to start going down as low as 10, and I actually had a 9-year-old because, you know, the average age in the United States that kids are first exposed to pornography is now 8.
Oof.
Chronic begins at 11. When you hand them a device, as a parent, you have to recognize that you are handing them access into a global community with about 5 billion people that are on. And so when you do that, you don't have the safeguards that are in place. And we can talk about why that is, but you can't become a police state for your kids all the time. And the industry knows where those kids go. So, you know, my time in the FBI, I worked in homicidal pedophilia. I used to worry about kind of the vans driving by the parks, picking up the kids, right? Today, you don't need a van. You don't need to go to the parks. All you have to do is know where the kids spend their time on apps. And anybody can find that information by simply looking up what are the most popular apps, what are downloadable, and where are the kids spending their time. And then they can go in and they can introduce themselves. And that's the breadth of the work that I do is,
right,
you know, peer injuries and then predatory injuries that occur.
Is social media addiction, is it on the same level as other addictive behaviors that you see in either within that age group or adults, whether it's, you know, alcohol or smoking too much, eating too much, video game addiction, things like that? Is it on the same level? Is it different? Like, where do you rank? I don't even know if you you shouldn't rank addictions, I guess.
You want me to build a hierarchy for you?
Yeah. Like, is it as important? Is it as serious? Like, where does that fit in?
Well, yeah, I would argue that it's more important and more serious.
Okay.
A, because it's innocuous, right? I think that that our society and our culture has been trained to believe that tech is good and that it's going to take us, and it can be good. Like, I'm not, you know, I'm not somebody that hates tech, but what happens is you don't typically have kids smoking, drinking, taking drugs, or in that elementary school age. And so when you introduce them to a technology whereby the adults are all willingly handing it over to the kids, the kids really don't know what the boundaries are. We're not actually doing educational training on the good and the bad and the ugly of what's happening there. So I think it's more dangerous. And I think that the important fact is, like, if you come from a family history where you have addiction, so whether it's alcoholism, drug addiction, eating addiction, things like that, your child would be more prone to be one of those children that is going to be influenced more. And if they're not from a family that has that as a history or a genetic trait, then are we priming those children to then become and create that, what we talked about, that dopamine reward pathway? Are we priming kids in that space to need more and more and more to get that juice? And therefore, if you get them early addicted to technology, now are they going to be more prone to doing vaping and drugs and alcohol, which is what I am seeing in my practice.
Okay. Wow. All right. So I want to get to the features that a lot of these companies are doing. And I got a lot of these features from the complaint in that multi-district lawsuit. But I want to ask you, I'm going to kind of read down the list of some of the things that they've designed into the programs and just talk about it for, like, what kind of effect that has psychologically on someone. So, for example, the first thing is a lot of them have these endless feeds. Sometimes we call it doom scrolling, where you do this with your phone, where you're scanning up and scanning up and scanning up, and the feed never stops. So what kind of psychological effect does that have on people when they do that?
So I'll pick two main ones on that one.
Yeah.
One is, we're not allowing people to have quiet, intimate, like, cognitive thoughts on their own. So there's no space of downtime for our kids, right? They can always be entertained and they can always have input. And so that part where with that creative thinking, where you kind of just take a minute and are able to kind of process out your day, kids are actually being robbed of that with that scroll. The second thing is that scroll tends to bring in information and things that the companies or the algorithm has decided is important to those kids. And thereby it's influencing them based on what they think that the kid needs to be paying attention to. And that could be other kids. It could be vacations. It could be whatever it is. But oftentimes that endless scroll, like, makes a kid's life feel quite boring because they're comparing it to the scroll of, like, all the amazingness that's getting presented to them.
Okay. Now, anecdotally, I see my teenagers using this, and I watch my kids as they're doing this. It's weird. I'm like an outside observer here.
Right.
But
yeah.
And is there a link between this and the anecdote of, oh, the kids' attention spans are getting shorter and shorter? Again, I grew up in the era where people were watching TV, and mm-hmm. and they said it way back then, like, oh, watching, you know, kids' attention spans keep getting shorter and shorter and shorter. And then we went from TV to YouTube, and then the YouTube videos were 5 to 10 minutes, and that was a horrible thing, because it's like, oh, their attention. But now we're at YouTube Shorts, which are under a minute. Or a minute, or an Instagram, and I watch my daughter, and it's like she's like three seconds, like she doesn't even watch the full video. It's
right.
Just like she decides within 3 to 5 seconds whether that initial image is important or not. Does that have an effect on their brain or their cognitive abilities, or is it just that she's bored and she's just looking for something to do?
I've talked for a long time about a technology acquired ADD, you know, with my kids in the population that I work in.
Yeah.
I think that for all of us, it changes. It definitely changes it. So if you think about it, it's more quantity over quality. And so, like, what kind of information and content are you actually getting if you're looking at something for 3 seconds and scrolling on? And then if you translate that outside of a phone device and it's an interpersonal communication with somebody, everything seems super slow, super boring. And so they start to kind of pull away from in-person communication or relationships, and they end up having most of their interactions on these devices.
Okay. Another feature that was mentioned of in social media was the lack of screen time limits. They do have an example of TikTok's take a break feature, but that isn't enabled until a minor logs 100 minutes a day. And then that's not even enabled by default. And I think you can just hit like ignore and that goes away. You don't even see that on a lot of these other platforms. Like, why is that a bad thing when in terms of the how much screen time is being used?
So it's not a bad thing. Yeah. I mean, I think that if we can create limits on what we're giving to our kids, I think it's a great thing. And I think that the industry gets kind of slapped on the wrist. They go into these legislative hearings and then they come back and they're like, well, look, like we're going to do this, take a break. But to your point, it's never defaulted. It's difficult to encourage. Kids just bypass it on ease. And so there's really no control over it. And they're banking on and they're trusting in the addictive process has already been engaged in, which is true. And so you're not going to get those to work in the same way. So, you know, I still believe that we have to have regulation and we have to have the ability to have, you know, screen mirroring and things like that for parents. Like there's a lot of things that could happen that could reverse that. But I think that those screen time limits are truly just an effort to appease the spotlight that's on them.
Right. Is that like the paying the lip service to the people that are complaining about all this stuff?
Right. And again, like there are really great people that work in that industry and they're the ones that are creating these mechanisms to try to help it. And I truly believe that they're doing it out of a cause of good and wanting that to happen. But it ultimately goes to the bottom dollar and whether or not the shareholders are happy. And the more time you get a kid to get off of a device, the less money you make.
Right. So. Right. All right. So another one that I read about was this thing called intermittent variable rewards. I think you guys, do you guys make the acronym IVR?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So let me see if I can explain this. So this is the ability to withhold likes until it appears that the user is about to go away. And that just seems really evil to me. Like, again, understanding that when I post something, sometimes I'm looking for those people to like me. But then there's something within the system that can detect if I'm about to put the phone down and then boom, 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 a like will happen. Is that what does it mean by intermittent variable rewards?
So that is the strongest addictive training that you could possibly do. If you have a fixed ratio, it means every 5 posts, you're going to get a like.
Okay.
Every 10 posts, so it's very fixed. So you would know on 1, 2, 3, and 4, you're not going to get it. So this is Vegas at its highest. The intermittent variable means that it happens, sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't, and it's variable. It could be the first time, it could be the fifth time. You could get 10 likes, you get 100 likes. That IVR system is the strongest in our own brain that creates that pathway of wanting it more. So it's like if you're going to get 10 units of dopamine for a fixed ratio response, you're going to get 1,000 with the independent variable response rate.
And this so was based on experiments that B.F. Skinner was doing, right? Way back.
Yeah, B.F. Skinner and the salvating dog. Yep. And the bell.
I remember my psych 101.
Oh, good. I know. I'm so proud of you.
Thank you. Thank you. All right. So another one was ephemeral content where they won't put dates and times on the content. So it's always there. It never feels old. I guess that creates a FOMO effect of people thinking that they're missing out on something where, you know, you can't go a day or two without this FOMO appearing, right? Like, that's a problem. Like, what, you know, is that why they don't put dates and times on a lot of the content that you see?
Yeah, I think that, the dates and times used to come up, right? And then they figured out very quickly that if it was too old, the people just wouldn't look at it.
Sure.
And wouldn't be engaged in it. So removing that creates kind of a stasis, like the person can be quote unquote relevant all the time. And so they're never getting negative feedback that they're missing out or they're doing something that would make them feel bad. So to me, it taps into that piece of like, it's too much. Like we're getting overwhelmed from a digital sense.
Yeah.
Like we have too much data and there's too much out there. If you remove all of that, then it never seems like it's overwhelming because you can always catch up, which is very tricky. And that's why they do it.
All right. Here's another one that blew my mind. And I was like, wow, that's really bad. Is with notifications when they have, this includes push notifications late at night, prompting a user to re-engage with the app no matter the cost to their sleep schedule. That just seems very insidious. Like, and I'm not sure if that means like you could turn off your notifications. I know that you can do that on the phone. But if you don't, the system has no like internal moral obligation. Is it designed to actually go, well, I know it's 1 a.m. where this user is, but I'm going to throw this push at them?
Well, it's a more vulnerable brain and system in late at night. So tiredness, anything that you can like look at, if you think of like if your brain isn't at optimal sleep, then you actually become a more vulnerable person in terms of those notifications and how you get attached to it. So it's basically reducing the productivity or the strength of us to be able to resist those things. So, you know, to me, it's like no technology should ever be in a bedroom or a bathroom in my world. I know that doesn't happen all the time, but that's why, because you can't truly control it. You can put on notification repressing or whatever, but teenagers don't do that. You know, they all think that they're trauma surgeons and they need to be available in the middle of the night, whatever it is.
That's a great analogy. All right. So can you talk a little bit about filters now? There's a lot of apps that have these filters that allow them to, you can edit a photo, you can edit a video, you can, basically create idealized content for how you look with fake appearances and experiences. It feels like this is done as like, oh, it's a fun thing. You can make yourself look a lot better than you really are. But this is a big problem in terms of kids thinking that they have a harmful body image, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Can you go into that a little bit more?
Yeah. I mean, the number of eating disorders that I see, the number of plastic surgery consults that are going up, I think that it's, to me, even in my own family, I had a niece who, you know, she was a little bit overweight when she was like 13. She did a Snapchat filter, put her nose ring on herself, full makeup. And if I fast forward to today, when she's 16, she literally looks like the Snapchat filter. She got herself a nose ring. She wears makeup every day. Like, you know, so it's like this part where, you know, if you look at kids that don't have that access and they're not on those things, they tend to be more age typified. You know, they're not going to have all of the things that are influenced on that. So it from a body acceptance rate, it really impacts the kids for confidence and acceptance with one themselves and their peer groups.
Mm. All right. Another one that comes up was the barriers to deletion. And we see this in not just social media, but in a lot of like streaming services and other account based things where, for example, Facebook, Instagram, it takes 7 different buttons through 7 different pages and pop-ups in order to delete or deactivate an account. And then there's still a 30-day waiting period during which user can reactivate their account simply by logging in. Is that like, you know, oh, yeah, you can quit this. Like, this is your dealer telling you can quit anytime. I'll be right over here. Like, is it that equivalent of, well, we're not really going to go away. We know you want to quit, but we'll be here when you're ready to come back, right?
Right. And is there anything to stop them in that 30-day waiting period to do notifications or do things that like impress upon you to like go back in or a friend mentioning it or whatever it is? Like they know that 30-day waiting period is the part that creates it. So
right.
You know, the fact that they, you know, as a user, right, I always educate kids when I'm out in schools and stuff that the product is actually you, like you're the product in this system. And so as the product, they're actually telling you that you don't have value in this decision making. So even if you decide to quit, we're going to tell you that you don't, that's not really what you want. And we're going to make that decision for you. And kids really respond well when you tell them, here's how they're manipulating you. Here's how they're treating you. And so it's an abusive relationship. And so we really have to look at it as it is.
Yeah. And again, there's like 3 or 4 more things that I want to do. This is going to be a quick hit thing. Quick add functions that let children talk to adults. That sounds like a bad idea.
That is a terrible idea.
Yeah. Private chats is another thing that I think a lot of parents might not realize that are out there, right?
Right. I mean, that to me is terrifying because that in almost in every gaming system, every social media instance, like, I mean, this was back at AOL, they had that and we had like huge problems 20 years ago and we still now are facilitating it and giving these private areas for abusers to go in and predators to go in and attack our kids.
And I think you mentioned this earlier, the geolocation features on some of these apps. I know that Snapchat definitely has that because I see my kids using it And all right, so I'm going to give you a quick story. So my two daughters are both on Snapchat, and I will take one of them out to dinner because the other one is doing something. And the one who I'm not with will immediately text the other one and going, "Where are you? What are you doing?" And they can see that we're at like a restaurant. And then she means it's like, "Hey, get me something," or "Why did you go without me?" And there's, you know, she gets all mad if I take one of the kids out to dinner. And I have to tell them, turn off your Snapchat geolocation. Like, she should not know where you are at all times, or, you know, one or the other. And it's amazing that are these turned on by default, I guess, with some of these apps?
Yeah, not only are they turned on by default, but if you try to turn off the location setting on Snapchat, you lose access to the filters, which is what makes it fun for them.
Oh, so I didn't know that.
So they attach it to other things so that if you turn those things off, they're like, "Oh, but you know what? Your services aren't going to work this way."
Oh, boy. Boy, that just seems wrong. All right. So then age verification. I think we talked a little bit about this. What, you know, the companies might come out and go, "Oh, but you know, you have to be 13 in order to use this, or 14 or whatever." These are horrible age verification systems, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. There's no mechanism to verify it at this point. They've been addressed. They're talking about how they're going to do it. 13 is a magic age that COPPA, which is a legislative protective order for kids, Child Online Protective Act that we have. But that magic age of 13 to me is ridiculous because it's snap dab in the middle of the middle school hormonal fire dumpster years. And then we give kids like access to everything. It's like ridiculous. And so I think that there needs to really be some like reset in terms of like when that is. And if it could be, to me, if it's after 16, then I think we would have at least a fighting chance as a society.
All right. So I want to get into some of the parenting parts of this because you're a parent. I'm a parent. My director, Chris, has a 1-year-old, and he's already told me that he's only going to give his daughter the old Nokia brick phone when she gets old enough to use a phone. I've threatened to give my kids the old. Remember, was it Cricket or Ladybug? There's some phone for either young people or old people where you just have one button and it just says call dad or call mom.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So but as I was talking with you about this stuff, even, you know, before the show and now during the show, I start feeling really guilty. Am I a bad parent for allowing my kids to have this stuff? Now, again, I don't think they're addicted. I do see them scrolling, doom scrolling, and doing all of this stuff. And most of their posts are usually there to help promote something, some club that they're in, or, you know, they're not doing anything that, at least I don't think they are.
Right.
So can you make me feel better, I guess? And then talk about what you do as a parent, because you're so aware of all of these things.
Right. So if you define it under, we've let our kids into the access without training, I mean, every parent would be considered a bad parent if that's going to be our measure. But the reality is the tech industry sold a narrative that these are safe. They're going to be good for our kids. They did it very calculated in a way where they sold it as like an educational media first. They went into the schools. If you look at Steve Jobs, you look at Bill Gates, it was very, very calculated in the way that it came about. And so as a parent, I don't think that we really had an opportunity because nobody was looking out for us on how to do it. And as you know, unless I was the only parent that wasn't given the parent handbook, like, you know, we kind of have to wing things as they come along in life in every aspect. So technology is no different in that. I would say that not all tech is equal. And so as a parent, if you're paying attention and you're understanding and you're watching your kids and you're recognizing like mood changes, withdrawal, things like that that are happening, I always say tech is a tool, not as a toy. And so some of the social media platforms, some of the things that the streaming apps and things like that, like that is the part that is kind of the junk food of technology. And so if we look at that and we're like, okay, well, it's okay to have a donut every now and again, but we're not going to let them have a dozen donuts every day. Like they would be sick. So as a parent, we just have to kind of learn it's okay to do a little bit of it. We have to train our kids. And this is the part that like has, you know, kept me up at night and got me writing books and things like that, is like, we've got to train our kids to be part of the narrative and understand the system. If they understand that they're getting manipulated, if they understand the addictive nature of it, very similar to drugs and alcohol, like we have to have those conversations and we have to be able to say it's not all created equally. So, you're not a bad parent.
Okay.
You're paying attention to what your kids are doing.
Yeah.
You're having conversations with them. And I think that it goes back to bringing them in and saying, hey, like, here's how this system works. What do you think?
Yeah.
I'm a true believer in having their voice a part of it.
When I first became a parent, I I've been covering the technology space for years and years. And so, you know, when they were really, really little, it was all the issue of like the net nanny stuff. And it was like the early days of the internet and, you know, make sure that your kids aren't going to bad websites and setting up filters. And it was never about shutting them down. And, you know, all the conversations I had with them was like, don't talk to any strangers online. Make sure you know you're only making friends with the people that you know, that you know, and don't kind of do all that stuff. So I felt like I was pretty safe. But then like the phones and the social media then came on, and at that point, like you said, I was just, maybe I wasn't aware of what was going on there. But again, having those discussions, I think, is a good thing.
I think that's, and giving them the ability to say, I may have made a mistake, right? So a lot of times when I'm asking kids in my clinical practice, I'll ask them, I was like, you know, how many nudes have you received? How many have you sent? How many have you, right? Like, and I just make the assumption that they have, you know, what age were you? Well, because I'm telling you, it's clearly way over 80% of my kids are exposed to these things.
And when you say your kids, not your personal kids, these are the kids you work with.
My clinic over the last 20 years.
Yeah.
So I have a 15 and 16 year old. To answer your question about as a parent, what I did, I do not have them on any social media. My daughter could care less. She's a 16 year old. My son asked me probably on a weekly basis when he's going to get Snapchat as a freshman in high school. But I haven't let them on it, not because I don't trust my own children. I don't trust the industry. And I know that the industry is out to gather their time, their attention, and their focus. And so my kids aren't typical. My daughter is still at 16, doesn't wear makeup. She's 5'10", and she's a beautiful girl, but she's age appropriate. You know, 16 year old who's on that, you know, she's a soccer player. And so it's just interesting to see them, but they do struggle sometimes fitting in with other peers because they don't have those things. So, you know, it's an interesting part. My conversations stem from, you know, I'm sorry that, you know, I have these restrictions. I'm sorry that I care about you enough to tell you that this is what I spend my life looking at, and this is why we're not going to do it.
Right.
It does make me different. Yeah.
I think the problems I've had has usually been with my youngest daughter. And again, because I think she was always asking for, like, when can I get TikTok? And I kept saying, you can't get it until you're a certain age, and kept saying no. And eventually she's now responsible enough with that kind of stuff. But her biggest problem is she wants me to get her a debit card. And then I'm like, okay, no.
Yeah.
You know, get a debit card. You get a job, then you get a debit card. And then it comes out of your money. All right. So
we use Greenlight. Greenlight actually gives, you know, like a little card that comes in the mail, but they have to earn all the money on their chores.
But then that's extra work for me as a parent. I was like, and then you have to start clicking buttons and monitoring all that stuff. I was like, well, I'd rather just wait till you get a job and then earn your own money. And then, you know, like, I'll pay for all your stuff until you're 16 and then you go out and get a job. One of the questions I want to ask you, you had started bringing up the idea of parents being able to recognize mood changes and things like that. Can a parent distinguish between whether the mood change is part of a social media component versus just the regular stuff that goes on during adolescence? Because mood changes and things like that were always an issue with teenagers as a teenager growing up, right? I mean, that's right. So how can a parent tell whether this is something that's bothering them from a phone use versus just, it's just I'm going through my goth phase or something like that?
Right. So typically, like it has to do with the withdrawal of the technology. So if parents are starting to put in some of the parameters that I would suggest, like, we're not going to have technology at dinner, we're not going to have technology in our bedroom, we're going to, you know, so there's like, you kind of create this kind of recession of time that they're using, and you see them react in certain ways, like that they're like super anxious or they're super depressed or they're missing out on something, then you know it's attached to something that's happening through the phone.
Okay.
So there's ways to test that theory on that. But you're right. I mean, it's very complicated on how you can tell. I tell parents all the time, if you can afford to have someone, whether it's through church or through a clinician or whatever, that your kids can go at least once a month to go talk to an outside source, do it, and figure out how to get that done. Because kids tend to talk to me. It's not that I'm asking them any other questions that you would ask as a parent, but I'm not their parent. And so they share. And so having that kind of outside area where they can feel safe and have a conversation shouldn't be about when something's already broken. Yeah. I always say, you know, it's better to do it and say, like, this is just part of self-care. You should have a person that you can go to and kind of like divest your days with and throw problems at and see what they say. So.
All right. And then the other phrase I'm going to use, which I'm hesitant to use, is, well, this is just a phase. Is this problem with social media addiction something that can last into young adulthood or even with regular users of social media? I've seen a lot of colleagues and friends that are constantly on, like, and they're posting. It's more about posting rather than maybe consuming, because there might be a little difference there, right? But
right,
you've seen addictive behavior with adults too, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and I think in the gaming industry itself, like the highest adopters, like during COVID, were like 30 to 40 year old moms, you know? So like, and then now we've got a whole huge problem of these moms that are like on there and like, haven't left the platform. So the thing is, the industry knows how to keep us attached. They know how to keep us focused. And so, you know, if you're asking me how do we differentiate if it's going to be a lifelong issue versus like a time, to me, that's an education piece.
Okay.
Right? You know, and to me, I treat tech like eating. So if you look at Overeaters Anonymous and some of the programs that you go through for that, like you have to learn how to use food properly.
Right.
And you have to have a different relationship. It's a psychological distinction, and you have to be able to accept what, you know, like sugar does into the brain, and it potentiates higher than like high fructose corn syrup potentiates higher in the brain than heroin. And when you know that,
right,
now you're, oh, maybe I shouldn't be eating like the high fructose corn syrup because it's going to make me want it more, or the diet soda or whatever it is. So you have to, in tech, teach them those things. And so it's using, to me, I think it's using data and science with the kids, using stories, having peers tell their story about what happened to them. And that to me will be the part where they can actually learn that they don't want to be the product anymore. They might want to be a voice in how we use it, which is great. But I hate when I see people that are passively getting taken advantage of and without the knowledge.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess that leads me to the next question of where does this go? Like, does this get solved because of the lawsuit and potential settlements that happen? And maybe there'll be an acknowledgement that they have been doing all of this. Or is it more just we continually have to raise awareness and keep people informed about all of this stuff? Like, what is there an end game at any point with any of this stuff?
You know, that's a great question, because I think that Gen Z is the most powerful cohort in history from a technological perspective. Uh-huh. And they are the most vulnerable and the most damaged by it all. And so for me, like, you know, to me, like creating programs and going out and educating is what we have to do. I think that the lawsuit will certainly create a systemic change, but I worry a tad, right? Like if we go in and we attack the industry as we did the Silk Road, if you remember from the darknet. So the darknet.
I don't remember that. Yeah, go ahead and refresh my memory on that.
So they called it the Silk Road, and it was kind of this dark net. You had to go through a special browser. You get into the dark net, and literally in this area, you could buy organs, you could buy guns, you could buy cocaine, drugs, anything you wanted on this dark net. And it was unregulated, and it was like the secret society that you had. Well, that secret society, so they basically went in, they infiltrated it from a legal perspective, like investigators did. They went in and they shut down the Silk Road. So what happened is that Silk Road community, which was about, let's just say 100 different components within it, became 100 million different ones. The dark net still exists. You can still get through a special browser, but now it is so much more powerful.
They were at least
trying to self-regulate. So my fear is if we come in and we eviscerate Snapchat and TikTok and we blow them up now because they have a monopoly, right? There is a standard that they're following. It's not good enough for you or I or for our kids. But if we get rid of them, then we're going to have hundreds of thousands of little Snapchats. And how do we regulate that? So I worry a little bit about it turning into that. And so we've got to figure out a really smart and thoughtful approach from the legal perspective so that we're not actually like kind of spiting ourselves in that situation.
You mentioned Gen Z, and I remember reading an article about how there was a survey of older teenagers, and they asked them if they recognized that they had an addiction problem to social media. And I think there was a question was like, would you want your 8-year-old sister to be on social media? And the vast majority is like, no. Like, they do they understand the problems do they understand that they're being productized? And then they don't want it for the next generation. So that does give us hope that they'll be the ones that maybe turn this around for future generations.
Right. So I go and speak nationally, and I will hand to God on my mother's grave. Like, I've never, ever, 100% of the time, I've asked older students, how many of you have younger siblings? They raise their hand. 100% of them have lowered their hand. None of them want their younger siblings. So, and
that's, maybe that was you that told me that. That's why I remember this.
Yeah. So Digital Citizen Academy, yeah. I created like a technology leadership council under that guise, right? So I have a peer-to-peer mentoring program whereby I take the older students, I create them to do the campaigns and the voice and the education on their campuses so that the younger students are benefiting from their mistakes or their errors or their wisdom. And so I think that, you know, we just have to accept, like, kids don't want to hear it from adults, but if they hear it from other kids and they start to become part of the solution, it's been wildly like successful on that front.
Yeah. And Chris just reminded me, our director, that it's a lot like smoking or drinking soda. Like, you know, older generations do something for a while, and then like younger generations don't smoke as much as the older generations did. And younger generations are more likely to be into healthy eating, I think, because of they understand some of the dangers of. That does give us hope, right? That other generations will take care of this for the next generations. Yeah, but then there'll be something else, right?
Yeah. I mean, well, of course. I mean, now we've got AI and deepfakes, and we can do that on another talk if you want, because that's like super crazy of like, you know, how we're going to manage that for our kids. But on the social media front specifically, I think it's like the tobacco litigation and the opioid addiction and all of that stuff. It's like there's going to have to be a regulatory change. There's going to have to be black box warnings on stuff. Like, and we'll get there. You know, it's not comfortable getting there.
Yeah.
Going up against a $1 billion industry is scary, you know, and I think through kind of like the witnesses and the things that, you know, like there's risk in that, but it has to be done and somebody has to step up and be willing to be brave to do it.
Do you feel like with all the work that you do, do you ever feel like Don Quixote kind of tilting at the windmills here, or do you feel like you're making progress in raising the awareness and, you know, getting parents to understand about this problem? And I threw in a literary reference for you, too.
Yeah, thanks. I like that. Yeah. Look at that. You've got like Psych 101 and literary.
I'm a man of all seasons. I'm a big generalist. Yeah.
You know what? I look at it as the power of one. Right. So I'm launching that my podcast on that because I wrote about it. I wrote about like how one person in the world can make a systemic change. One person in my life changed and helped me get to where I am today. And I think that, you know, I've had thousands upon thousands of students go through my program. And I will tell you that I will go back. Like, I went on a trip. I gave, you know, one of my kids went through the program at apparently second or third grade in elementary school. And I went on a trip. And at 17, that child came up to me and said, oh, Dr. Lisa, like, I just have to tell you, like, I remember when you came to my school and you said this. And she's like, I was the only one of my friends that never sent out a nude. And she's like, and I got popular because of it.
That's awesome.
So anyway, Yeah. So, you know, I have those, I have like tons of those little anecdotal like stories. And so like, that's what matters to me. Like, am I pushing a sea change? I hope so. Am I getting the kids to start talking about it? I know I am. So, you know, it's going to take all of us to do that.
That is amazing. And I'm hoping that your work will continue. And again, thank you for being on the show, Dr. Lisa Stroman, again, just for everything that you're doing to help raise the awareness here. It was awesome.
Thank you. And you're a great parent.
Oh, thank you. I wasn't fishing for that, but I'll take it.
Yeah, okay. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. That's all the time we have for today's episode. Don't forget to like the video, subscribe to the channel, add any thoughts you have below. Join us every week for new episodes of Today in Tech. I'm Keith Shaw. Thanks for watching.